Hey, Mac Geeks, it is Saturday, February 19th, 2005. This is your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geek. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. All right, I have to, again, be honest with you guys. It is actually just past midnight on Sunday, so it's now officially Sunday, February 20th, but things have gotten away from me. I normally you'd be getting this show on Friday evening, but life gets in the way and things happen and you get a little behind. So hopefully you don't mind me being a little late on this one. But we have a ton of stuff to cover, so I'm going to jump right into it. So in the continuing saga of the Motorola iTunes cell phone, we've been going back and forth. I think I announced to you guys the model, the E1060, and then last show we said, oh, well, that's not the model. Motorola came out and said that wasn't the model. Well, now we have the official model. It is the Rocker, the ROKR. That's right. Motorola is calling it the Rocker, and that will be the iTunes compatible cell phone. What's interesting about it is they're actually going to limit the number of tracks you can put onto the phone, so it's somehow apparently not going to be limited by the size of the memory or the storage capacity of the phone, but limited in some other manner. And they're saying they're doing that because Apple wants to protect the iPod portable music player business. So very strange to me that they would be sort of inhibiting the ability of the phone right out the gate. And it just goes to further prove, kind of, not really prove my point, but kind of demonstrates how when we merge cell phones and MP3 players and digital cameras and all these things, trying to merge it all into one device, we're not getting the best device we can possibly get. And I don't know why nobody's got it right yet. I've asked for feedback, and I got feedback from people, and a lot of people agree with me, but there's also a lot of people that are asking, well, why can't we have a camera that has a 5-megapixel lens in it? There are cameras out there like that. And why can't we have one that has a, 20 gigabyte MP3 player that works with iTunes in it? And why can't it be a great cell phone and a great MP3 player and a great phone? The answer? I don't have the answer. I don't know why. You would think from a technical standpoint, should be capable, but we haven't seen the device yet. So, there you have it. But anyway, iTunes phone is going to be called the Rocker, and have no idea what it looks like or when it's going to be out, but Motorola at least has released us the name. A few shows back, we also talked about the fact that there were some rumors that Sony might be working deals with Apple, and one of those rumors was a potential buyout, Sony buying Apple. Well, I never put much faith in it, and the president of Sony, Kunitaki Ando, came out in a, not press release, but an interview, and basically confirmed that, Sony's not going to be buying Apple. And the obvious reason, as he points out, is because Apple is just too expensive. Look at the stock price. Sony just, has no interest in paying that much for Apple. So not going to happen. I think that's a good thing. I'm sure Sony and Apple have many other partnerships or at least talkings in the works. To further prove the point that Sony's not going to be buying out Apple, the president also said they are going to be improving their MP3 players and should have a very good competitor for the iPod coming out before the end of the year. So we'll have to wait to see that from Sony. We know they're supporting MP3 format now, which they held off on for a really, really long time, and I think was really hurting them. But they're back in the game, so they say. We'll see. Okay, coming up next, I got a ton of rumor news for you. Starting out with the classic, we've been talking about this theory that a lot of people have that when Apple changes the availability from a product on the online store from shipping next day to shipping in 7 to 10 days or some other longer period, that a lot of people speculate this means there's a revision of the device coming out. In this time, last time we talked about the iPod Mini, and we're going to be talking a little bit more about that in a second, but this time it is the iMac. Apparently, on Apple's online store, the iMac has been changed from next day availability to 7 to 10 days availability. And people are saying, well, this is a rumor that we're going to see a revision of the iMac G5. We'll just have to wait and see. The other rumor kind of confirming this, I just read about this. I didn't know this had existed, but sources are saying that Apple has had a stable 2 gigahertz iMac running for a while now, or had the ability to produce that machine. So now people are saying because they changed the ship date lead time on the online store that we're going to see new iMacs. I don't know. What's happening, though, is there's a very, very strong indication that by Wednesday or on Wednesday next week, Apple's going to make some sort of announcement. And so I'm just going to let the rumors flow through here. So the first thing is this iMac revision. The next one we have, and we talked about a little bit already, is new iPod minis. And we talked about the possibility of a 5 gigabyte hard drive. And I asked for feedback on that. And basically the consensus was that most people agreed with me. A bump from 4 gigabytes to 5 gigabytes isn't really that huge. And some people were saying, well, we want to see new colors. And other people were saying, you know, other things. But the latest news now is that the hard drive will be bumped to 6 gigabytes. And they're saying it's going to be a Seagate drive. And it's interesting because Seagate doesn't have a 6 gigabyte 1-inch hard drive like would be in the iPod mini. But apparently, through other sources, it's been said that, and was confirmed, I think this was from Apple Insider. Apple Insider confirmed that there are current iPod minis using 5 gigabyte Seagate drives, but that Apple has a firmware in there that restricts the size when it's actually used to 4 gigabytes. Very interesting, and I think their Apple Insider is saying they've confirmed that Apple is receiving these drives from Seagate. So apparently there's some people out there with 4 gigabyte iPod minis that actually have 5 gig drives in them from Seagate. And Hitachi was the original supplier of the 4 gigabyte drives. And they're saying Apple was doing that because to get iPod availability up. They needed another supplier for drives. Hitachi was unable to supply the 4 gigabyte drives fast enough. So anyway, so that shows that Apple has a relationship with Seagate, and apparently Seagate has 6 gigabyte 1-inch drives ready to go. So they're saying we're gonna see 6 gigabyte iPod minis. And then the other bigger news that people are rumoring about is that the iPod mini is going to get a color screen, and that color screens are going to happen across the entire iPod line before the end of the year. I think that would be a great move, especially if Apple keeps the prices all at the same price, or even brings them down. That will definitely solidify, I think, the iPod's place in the MP3 player market. Let me know what you think on that. I just think, you know, if Apple can pull that one off, it's going to be, you know, iPods for the rest of the year, and I think they're going to remain in the top spot that they've held for a while. So along with that, more iPod rumors. They're also saying the standard white iPods, the 20, 40, and 60 gigabyte models, are going to be getting color options, just like the iPod minis. There's no confirmation for that. It's just a rumor. Just thought I'd throw it out to everyone and let you know what you think. Want to hear what you think about it. So send me an email or an MP3 audio comment. You know, I think that's great. We like variety. We like options. We like to personalize our stuff. So color iPods would be a wonderful thing. Last thing in the iPod rumors is that maybe potentially iPods will be getting Bluetooth built in. And this comes from the website Mac Forever. And it's apparently based on a slip that a Motorola executive made in France. And he quote-unquote accidentally confirmed that Apple would introduce iPods with built-in Bluetooth. And this just makes sense. I mean, we should have Bluetooth iPods because, you know, Apple supports Bluetooth. Bluetooth is showing up in our cell phones. It's showing up in these Bluetooth wireless headsets. And I'm sure it would be, there's going to be, if there aren't already, I haven't seen them, but I'm sure they already probably exist, Bluetooth car stereos, where you can have your Bluetooth, you know, cell phone, and you can play cell phone calls through your car stereo, so you can do a hands-free type thing. Next logical step, you have your Bluetooth iPod. You hit play on your iPod, it plays right into your stereo wirelessly. You don't have to hook up these cassette tape adapters or line-in adapters or special cables. You know, wireless is the wave of the future, and you know, Bluetooth is going to be the way to go for an application like that. So I really hope that happens for the two reasons, hooking up to your stereo and for just having wireless headset that would work with your cell phone and your iPod. That is one area of convergence I think I'd like to see happen. So that's it for all the iPod rumors. Here is the one last bit of iPod news I have for the evening. iPod Shuffles are going to be available at Target. They've been available, I guess, on the online store, or are going to be available on Target.com, but also in all stores in 47 states. But don't rush out just quite yet, because they don't expect availability for another 2 weeks. So in about 2 weeks, you should be able to get your iPod Shuffle from Target. So it'd be really cool if they did one of those cool Target dog commercials. They have those in the U.S. I don't know if they have them in other countries, but basically, if you remember Spuds McKenzie from the Budweiser commercials way back when, they have a dog like Spuds McKenzie, and they're pretty cool ads and pretty funny. So it'd be cool to see an iPod Shuffle one or an Apple one of those ads. So we've been talking a lot lately about on the MacCast about switchers and switching from PC to Macintosh, and there is a reporter over at CNET named Charles Cooper. And he just announced late last week, that he is switching forever. He's switching to the Mac, and he's never going back to the PC. And this is interesting because he's been a PC user for 20 years. So, you know, it's happening, people. People are jumping ship, and they're coming over to the light side, as it were. And we're happy to have him on board. If you want to check out his comments, there's a link from the show notes to the article over on CNET. CNET's news.com website, where Cooper says he's switching. So very interesting little read. It's short, nice and sweet article. Real quickly, I want to jump off on the thought I'm having now about show notes. I put the links for everything on the MacCast that I talk about in the show notes. I'm hoping that they're useful for people, but I haven't really heard, and I don't have any way to track how many people are actually reading or using the show notes. So I'd like to find out, because they do take, you know, some time and effort to put together, how many of you are actually using the show notes or have went over and, you know, use that to get a link. I do it because I figure a lot of people are listening in their car and maybe don't remember websites or URLs I might mention. So let me know if you're using it or if you aren't. Just like to hear if I should continue to keep doing the show notes and putting those together every week. So something that comes up quite often and I'm asked about quite a bit is performance, Macs versus PCs, which is better? There's a great website called barefeats.com. It's barefeats.com. And they posted a rundown just recently of the fastest Macs versus the fastest PCs. And guess what, folks? The Macs in pure CPU tests won hands down. And I'm going to give you the configurations so you can see that they were doing fair comparisons here. And so what they put together was a dual G5 2.5 gigahertz power Mac with 4 gigabytes of RAM, a dual 5G5 2.0 gigahertz power Mac with 4 gigabytes of RAM, a dual Xeon 3.4 gigahertz with 4 gigabytes of RAM, a dual Opteron 2 gigahertz with 2 gigabytes of RAM. And the Xeon, for those who may not be familiar, is the Intel processor, and the Opteron is the AMD processor. And then a Pentium 4 3 gigahertz, that's a single processor with 2 gigabytes of RAM, and a 64-bit AMD Athlon 2.2 gigahertz with 3 gigabytes of RAM. So those are the machines they used, all high-end PCs, the best you can get versus the high-end Macs. And they ran tests in After Effects 6.5, Cinebench using Cinebench 2003, Photoshop 7 with both multiprocessor and single processor actions, Bryce 5, and they had the help of the San Diego Supercomputing Center and a company called Whisper PC, who I think supplied or put together PCs for them. And the Mac won hands down in almost every CPU test except the Photoshop multiprocessor test, which I actually found that very interesting. But you can get the full details over on the barefeats.com website if you want to see the full rundown. I will tell you guys that they also ran 3D graphics tests, basically using all the latest high-end 3D games, and the Macs got smoked. So, you know, if you're into gaming, heavy into gaming, then, you know, maybe the Mac's not for you. I'm not saying the Mac's not a great game platform. The Mac is a very great game platform, so no one, you know, send me flame emails on that. But it's just not optimized for it. Basically, the software that the gaming companies write, they optimize for the PCs. It's a bigger market for them. So that's just the facts of life, and we deal with that. But for pure CPU horsepower, the Macs are, you know, winning hands down. So don't fall victim to the megahertz myth. All right. Okay, here's something interesting, and I'm not sure how I feel about it, but you guys are all familiar probably by now with Rendezvous, which is Apple's zero configuration networking standard. So, you know, iChat uses Rendezvous to find other users on your network. You don't have to configure it. You don't have to worry about IP addresses or anything like that. It also works with printers and other types of devices that are on a network. Apparently, last year, Apple was sued by, let me get the name of the company here, TIBCO Software of Palo Alto, California, over a trademark dispute about the name Rendezvous. And apparently, what I was reading was it got settled out of court in a mutual agreement between Apple and this company. And I guess the details of the settlement is that Apple agreed to phase out their use of the word Rendezvous. So Apple will be replacing that with the Bonjour. So Rendezvous is going to become Bonjour, and I'm not sure how I feel about that name. One thing, I have obviously trouble saying it, but it's just an interesting choice of terms. I'm not sure why they picked that, but that's what it's going to be. If you have any thoughts or comments on it, please let me know what you think. All right, appreciate it. Okay, last bit of news items for this evening. Many of you may be wondering, like I am, you know, when's Tiger due? When are we going to see 10.4? Well, one thing that's pointing to it may be a little while longer is Apple is going to go ahead and release another version of Panther, another update to Panther. They're already working on 10.3.9, so not sure when that update's going to be coming out. Apparently, it's being tested internally right now. But we will have another update of Panther to go through before we see Tiger. I'm guessing Tiger is going to be right at the end of May, possibly early June. Seems to be when Apple normally releases their OS X updates, right before the summer. So looking forward to it, but we'll have to see what improvements are in 10.3.9. So after Wednesday's show, I got probably the most feedback I've ever received from any of my shows. And so I thank everyone who's sent in emails, sent in audio comments, left messages on the voice line. Really, really appreciate the feedback. We're really getting to the point where this show's becoming interactive and really two-way communication between myself and all the other listeners out there. And I think it's wonderful. So anyway, the first thing I got was a big correction, and I want to thank listener Ed for this. I had commented on my opinions that Apple agreed to not serve the subpoenas to have these two websites, PowerPage and ThinkSecret, release the sources that they used to leak rumors about the announcements at Macworld. And I was saying that, you know, we need to protect First Amendment rights, and I'm glad that that Apple decided to do that. And, you know, I thought they were bad for going after these guys. I still think, just from a philosophical standpoint, you know, Apple should leave these two sites alone. But as far as protection for sources for journalists, there are no, Ed, you know, corrected me, what he says is there are no confidentiality protections for sources for journalists. There is no law that says a journalist has the right to protect the sources who give him information. It's not like doctor-patient privilege, you know, when you're talking to your doctor. So that doesn't apply. So, you know, corrected me on that, and I really appreciate it. I'm obviously not a legal person, not a lawyer, and I'm glad to have that additional bit of knowledge so that I can speak a little more eloquently when I'm discussing that sort of thing. But I'm going to go back and just say, you know, philosophically, I don't agree with what Apple's doing. All right. Next, I have a comment from listener Greg, and he actually makes a couple comments here and then has a question that I want to address. So here's Greg.
Hey there, Adam. It's Greg here. Once again, just wanted to ask for some help. You'd mentioned that this is our podcast, and so I have a couple of issues. But before I get into that, I just want to comment on the whole Emacs versus Mini question that you raised in your last podcast, and specifically relating to flat panels. I made a move from a G3 iMac, the CRT version, the Bondi, and to iMac flat panel, and I gotta tell you, it was a blessing. It was great. I mean, the quality of the CRT just can't be beat. So if you can't afford a good flat panel, the integrated Mac is certainly the way to go, in my opinion. And I agree with you. That Emac is a really nice machine. And if I was buying another machine, I would seriously look at that. For the price, I think it's great value. The other comment I wanted to make is I have been using the Podcast Tuner software that's in alpha, and it's really great. It's in version 0.2 now, and I noticed that the last few times it's been downloading your show notes, but that for some reason the last on the 14th and the 16th it didn't download the show notes. So I just thought I'd inquire about that. The other thing was in terms of OS 10 updates. I guess I've been using the updates as soon as they come out. I'm wondering if other users have been doing the same thing. When I went from 10.3.7 to 10.3.8, I had some real problems. I lost a whole morning and part of an evening trying to get my Mac back up. Everything was incredibly slow, especially as it relates to anything related to the internet. It was incredibly slow. I was really disappointed. And I guess one of the questions I have, is this a sloppy coding issue on behalf of Mac and what they're doing with their updates? Or is this some other issue? What I ended up having to do was delete all my cookies and repair my keychain. And redo all my passwords and stuff, of course, when I had to repair my keychain, and then had to delete all my internet cache and everything to get the machine back up. But it took quite a while to sort that through because I was on the update fairly quickly, and a lot of other people I've seen have had a lot of update problems, and some of the other geeks out there at Apple have been on the forums have been saying that. There's specific procedures that they go through when they do an update. And I've never done that before. I'm just wondering if other people have experienced the same thing. Anyways, I'd sure appreciate some feedback on that. And thanks for the MacCast. Listen to it. Yours and Adam Curry's is the two that I listen to every day. So certainly appreciate that. You got a great thing and glad to hear more of your opinions. So I'm just going to sign off for now and hope to hear some feedback. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, Greg. Great production value on that comment with a little intro and outro. But to address Greg's question, there is sort of an unofficial procedure that people go through in terms of running OS X software updates, system updates. I personally have never followed it, and I've never had a problem with any of my updates, except for 10.3.7, which it was a font issue, and that kind of became known after the fact. If you had too many fonts, your boot up time really slowed down. But besides that, I've never had any issues with an Apple update, and I've never followed the procedures. But just to give them out to everybody, basically the procedure that's recommended is that before installing an OS X update, so you know we just mentioned 10.3.9 coming out. So before you would do that, what you'd want to do is boot from your system CD and then use the Apple Disk Utility to verify and repair your Macintosh, your hard disk, and then also verify and repair the permissions on your disk. Then reboot back in, run the software update, and then after that, open Disk Utility again and run repair permissions again. And it's always a good idea before any update that you do that you make sure you have a full backup of your system. So those are kind of the things that people recommend. You know, like I said, personally, I don't do it. On the other comment about Podcast Tuner, I'm not really sure why you're not getting the show notes still. For those of you who don't know, Podcast Tuner is in alpha. It's alpha software, podcatching client that was put together by an actual Maccast listener, Hired Man, I believe he goes by. And if you haven't tried it out, go ahead and check out Podcast Tuner. What's really nice about Podcast Tuner is a couple things, but the main thing is that it will actually pull down automatically the show notes for you and display them right inside the application, the Podcast Tuner application, so if you haven't checked that out. But I went and downloaded it, and it seems to still be pulling the show notes for me, so I'm not sure why you're having issues with that. And then the last thing, the Emac versus iMac, appreciate your feedback on that. Somebody, you know, your opinion is the same as a lot of people I got feedback from. A lot of people agree with me that the Emac is a really nice alternative to the Mac Mini in terms of a cheap, inexpensive Mac, especially if you have to get all the components together, the keyboard, the mouse, monitor. If you don't already have all those things, then the Emac is a nice option because it's all just built in right there. It's nice and simple. But there's a differing opinion coming up, and actually I'm going to play it for you right now. Differing opinion from Antonio.
Hey Adam, it's Antonio. I'd like to make some comments about the email you received the other day from Richard about his friend's dilemma, whether or not he should buy an Emac or a Mac Mini. In my opinion, the Emac has a few points against it. First of all, the Emac is large and heavy. It's a big computer, very hard to move around. It was made for the school environment, and I think they made it really large and robust for a reason. That would be a point against the Emac for me. The other point against it is the CRT screen, because of a couple of reasons. First, working with a CRT for extended periods of time really can cause eye strain. I know I sit in front of a computer all day, and I'd rather sit in front of an LCD screen than a CRT screen, given the choice. Also, the CRT screen just uses so much more power. I think going with an LCD screen would just be a much better thing to do in terms of economics. Also, you can find a decent LCD screen for very little money. You just need to look around for it. Strangely, of all places, Dell actually has some good deals on LCD screens, and they put out some good LCDs. You could hook up a Dell screen to a Mac Mini if you didn't think they would explode from being connected. Also, the Mac Mini really wouldn't have that many cables attached to it if Richard's friend decided to go wireless. I mean, if he received the Bluetooth and AirPort Extreme options for the Mac Mini, then there would be no mouse cable, and there would be no keyboard cable, and there would be no internet cable because you'd have Bluetooth for the mouse and the keyboard and AirPort for the internet. Then the only thing that would be coming out of the Mac Mini would be two cables, the power cable and the monitor cable. And then one last thing, I would just like to say that I don't think the Mac Mini will replace the eMac, at least not in its current configuration. I think the eMac still has a lot of life left in it, and I primarily think it's for schools. I can't see schools purchasing Mac Minis because they're too small. They can be stolen very easily. The eMac is rather large, and it's one of those hard things that you can't quite fit in your knapsack. Okay, Adam, that's it. Looking forward to your next podcast. This is Antonio signing off.
That is Antonio broadcasting from, I think, the Bat Cave. Hey, Antonio, you might want to turn down the echo effect on your recordings, but thanks so much for the great feedback on the Mac Mini versus eMac. He makes some, you know, valid points. The one thing I would say is that buying the Bluetooth and wireless options, adding those onto your Mac Mini is going to drive up the base cost, and when we were discussing about it before, the guy who was thinking about getting the Mac Mini was trying to keep his costs as low as possible. But I totally agree with you about the displays, LCD displays. There's some great ones over at Dell. There's also some great ones, I think, at Gateway as well. So PC manufacturers have some good alternatives if you're looking for inexpensive LCD displays, and that's a really good point that Antonio makes there. So thanks, Antonio. So I just want to talk about two more things tonight. As I look down at my little time clock, we just hit 30 minutes, and I had asked for feedback from you on how you felt about me going longer on the show. I had initially started out trying to keep these shows 15 to 20 minutes and been slowly extending further and further over that time limit, that self-imposed time limit. But the feedback I'm getting is you guys are enjoying the show and you want to hear more. So I'm just going to let them run as long as I need them to run. Today we had a lot to cover, so we're going to run over 30-minute mark. I'm happy to give it to you if you want to listen. So we'll just keep it going. All right, very last thing to talk about tonight is the thing I said on the last show that generated the most feedback and the most controversy, and that was my comment about the Steve's email to the music industry concerning Napster and how users were able to sign up for the free trial and then convert files to a format where they could be burned to CDs, and then they could just cancel the subscription service and the music industry would miss out on all kinds of money. And I was saying that Steve shouldn't have done that because, you know, iTunes is just as vulnerable to having its files, the digital rights management removed and the files copied. But a lot of people pointed out a really valid point, and I want to let you listen to this comment, and then I'll make some final thoughts on the back end of it.
This is Access Deny recording from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My audio file is coming today in response to your comments that Steve Jobs should be careful, should have been careful when he was telling the recording industry about what Napster was doing in their DRM structure. I think you're way off base. I think Steve was making a fantastic and legitimate point. You were making the contention that any operating system can be used to circumvent digital rights management and thereby break copyright protection. That's true. But what Steve was saying, that this isn't a security issue to him or the recording industry. This is more particularly a logic error in how money is collected and passed to the recording industry. That's what he was trying to point out to them. The difference here is the business model of the store. Steve is telling them that iTunes Music Store is a better business model for them. So to put it in perspective, if someone joins Napster and they download like 300 tracks, and then they want to keep the music legitimately, they have to pay, I think it's $1 per song to burn it to disc. So that's going to gain $300 for Napster, and thereby passing royalties onto the recording industry. However, if they join for $15 for the month, and then they download 300 songs, and then circumvent the DRM, Napster's only gained $15 for that 1 month membership. Conversely, on the iTunes Music Store, if someone downloads 300 songs and then circumvents the DRM, it's no loss. Apple's still in possession of $300, and the amount of royalties associated with that is still passed on to the recording industry. Steve is basically telling the recording industry something like, hey, Napster's allowing people to download music without paying royalties to you. Now, we know that the iTunes Music Store may not be perfect after the music gets to the user, but you're still going to get your royalty check from Apple. You know, Steve said this before, the subscription-based model won't work. He's pointing out that they're not getting their deserved royalty money with Napster. That's what he's doing to them. They still get their money from Apple. That's what he's saying to them. You're going to get your money based on a download subscription. And in this industry, money talks more than long-term ideology. That's my two cents, and none of it's going to the recording industry.
All right. Axis makes a great point here, and a lot of people pointed the same thing out to me. And I totally agree that from a financial position, what Steve was pointing out makes a lot of sense. And I missed it the first time. Luckily, I have all you guys backing me up. And you pointed out, you know, my little error there. But I still want to make the point, and I think it still stands, that Steve sending this email tells the music industry, hey, you need to be watching everybody, and that everybody would include Apple. So while they may agree philosophically with Apple right now, it's going to keep the scrutiny and the pressure on all the music services to worry about DRM and, you know, making money. And, you know, it just sets kind of a bad precedence for the finger pointing, because the finger pointing can just as easily come back at Apple. So I think that still, that point still stands, but I agree that financially the music industry is in a much better position with the iTunes music service than they would be with these subscription-based services like Napster. All right, this was supposed to be the last comment, but I have to make a comment about something that just happened to me. You guys wouldn't realize this right up front, but we were just talking about the length of the show and going over 30 minutes, and that's something I don't normally do and haven't done very often. Well, I actually just reached, I record in GarageBand, as many of you may or may not know, I actually reached the physical limit in terms of measures in GarageBand. Apparently, GarageBand will only let you record up to 999 measures, and at which point you can record beyond that, but you can't actually play back that portion of the recording. And I went to Apple's support website, and they recommend splitting the track at that point and then pulling the remaining portion back into the playable area, the between measures and measures 1 and 999, which in my case isn't doable because I need this to go end-to-end. So I'm going to have to do something fancy after I mix down this program, probably splice things together using QuickTime Pro. But I may need to look at another recording program. I know a lot of podcasters use Audacity or also Audio Hijacks Pro. So I might be looking into a new application because GarageBand is not going to let me record much past 30 minutes. So I'm either going to have to keep the show short or shorten my podcasting time here. Anyway, just wanted to share that with you. Little annoyed about that. Hopefully Apple changes that. I'm going to be writing some letters. Anyway, that's the show for tonight. I'm going to be in New York on Monday, so I'll be recording the podcast from there remotely. Going to leave you tonight with some new music from a band called Hayworth. There's something special about this band. This band is actually the band of Pete, who does the Illinois podcast. You can check him out at www.illinois.us. That's illinoise.us. And I'm going to leave you with a track from Hayworth called Gasoline. Enjoy, and I will see you all next time.